For decades, first came love, then marriage, then the baby carriage. But the millennial generation is upending all of that. Fewer young adults than ever are tying the knot. Almost half of millennial women who give birth are not married. NPR's Jennifer Ludden has the latest in our series on the new boom.
It's lunchtime when I meet Michelle Sheridan and Philip Underwood at their apartment in Frederick, Maryland.
Oh, sweetheart.
2-year-old Liliana is hungry.
You'd think we don't feed you.
This is not Michelle's first child. 8-year-old Logan's at school. His dad left before he was born. She got pregnant again a year after she and Philip had moved in together. Like half of all pregnancies in the U.S., it wasn't exactly planned.
But it wasn't really like a bad time, or I don't know. It just seemed like an okay thing to do.
I stared at the pregnancy test for 10 minutes waiting for it to change.
You did stare at the pregnancy test for 10 minutes, but then he got really happy. It was actually really cute.
Decades ago, an oops would have meant a rush to the altar. But older millennials are children of the 1980s, the decade of the nation's highest divorce rate. Philip's dad walked out when he was a baby. Michelle's parents stayed together, but fought a lot.
That was hard to watch. I don't want to go through that, and I don't want my kids to see it.
So even though she's 28 and he's 32, they say the pregnancy never prompted thoughts of marriage. If anything, the opposite.
It changes the dynamic of the household. I had a friend who put off her marriage, got pregnant, and she's like, let's just wait, because we don't know if we're going to be able to make it through this. We don't know if this is going to change who we are. We don't know if it's going to change the stress level, and we'll be able to adjust to that.
One big stressor, money. Michelle spent years as a restaurant server, then pizza delivery driver. She got pregnant just as she'd managed to start college full-time with federal aid. Philip's a car technician, but he'd been through a rough patch work-wise.
It was so sporadic, and it would go from full-time 1 week to 20 hours the next.
Their apartment is government-subsidized. Things were so tight at one point, they shared a cell phone. But isn't that the time-honored way? Marry young and poor and work your way up?
No, that seems terrifying at this point. Like, it's hard enough to work up just on your own. Trying to work up as a couple seems like so...
She sighs at a loss for words.
50 years ago, when people graduated high school, they could go out and get a manufacturing job and have a pretty good wage, you know, some benefits.
But Arielle Cooperberg of the University of North Carolina, Greensboro, says those wages have been falling since the 1970s. The unemployment rate for high school grads today is double that for those with a college degree. It's not that lesser educated couples don't want to wed, she says. Cooperberg studied the labor market in 20 cities.
In cities that had better labor markets for people with less education, there was actually a smaller gap in marriage rates.
Cooperberg worries this changing economy is making marriage almost a luxury, something for only the better off.
And so here's a picture of our groomsmen and Dave.
In Harrisonburg, Virginia, Diana Black shows me her wedding album from last year.
Getting ready, here's my mom.
She and her husband Dave started dating in college. They now have graduate degrees and budding careers. Dave waited to propose until he got a handle on his student loans.
I had the bulk of them paid off at that point, and I felt like I was in a decent place to shell out the additional money for the ring.
They were the first in their circle to get engaged, but at 27, neither feels ready for children just yet.
For me, parenthood is such an enormous responsibility, and the longer I give myself, I feel like the better prepared I'll be.
That doesn't mean they're not planning. Dave and Diana take me to see the 4-bedroom house they recently bought. Big yard out back, good schools nearby, and upstairs, a perfect child's room complete with secret passage.
This door here goes to the attic, so for a kid, that would feel very Harry Potter-tastic, I think.
Two different stories. Two couples who each say they're acting in the best interests of their children. But researcher Ariel Cooperberg says this marriage divide could mean more inequality in the next generation. The problem, she says, is not that people are having kids without being married. It's that, on average, unwed couples are far more likely to split up by the time their child is 5.
And we know that that leads to other problems. It leads to some behavioral problems. It could lead to academic problems. It just leads to kind of less of a sense of stability, which hurts their chances later on.
Of course, it doesn't always happen that way. And not, it seems, for the first family we met.
Come here, sweetie.
Come here, sweetie.
Earlier this year, Philip landed a steady job as a car technician at Walmart. He says that made him think differently about proposing to Michelle.
I know every week I will be working 40 hours. I'm not making the most money in the world, but we're not financially tight.
We have diapers and everybody eats.
And
we can drive when we need to drive somewhere.
By the end of his first month on the new job, he'd bought a ring. She said yes. Since we spoke, Phillip's moved to an even better job, and they've set a date, next June. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News.
More now from American Made, our look at the changing face of American manufacturing. This morning, a company that's been in business for more than a century, producing dinnerware on the banks of the Ohio River in Newell, West Virginia. Most American ceramics factories closed long ago, unable to compete with Made in Japan or Mexico. But the Homer Lachlan China plant is still going strong, 141 years after opening, employing about 1,000 people. You might be familiar with its most famous product. It's that brightly colored pottery called Fiesta. NPR's Linda Wertheimer, who grew up with Fiesta, jumped at the chance to visit the factory.
My mother collected a warm yellow. My Fiesta is deep cobalt blue, just so you know where I stand. Fiesta is about half Homer Lachlan's business. The other half is dinnerware for hotels and the sturdy plates and cups you find at chain restaurants. Walk into the big, dim factory buildings, dusty and smelling of mud, and you might be back at Homer Lachlan's beginnings in the 19th century. People are sitting quietly in pools of light, carefully attaching handles to greenware, that's not yet fired coffee cups. Decorators are painting bands of color on glazed plates.
I'm just a hand liner. I put lines on. The orders tell me I need to put a 3/32, an eighth from the edge, and a 3/64, a 16th below, and a 3/64 verge.
Kevin Manypenny has worked in the Homer Lachlan factory since he was a teenager. He twirls a plate, dips a brush in brown glaze, and paints three delicate lines on the plate's edge. This plate is for a Boston restaurant. Manypenny finishes the plate and then tosses it onto a broad moving belt as if he were skipping a stone across water. Who plays catcher down the other end?
A younger brother.
James Manypenny, I go by Jim. I'm a kiln placer. I place ware on the kiln. It's not supposed to hit the floor.
He calls the ovens which fire the china kills, spelled K-I-L-N-S, but potters don't pronounce that N. 7 out of 8 of the Manypenny siblings and their parents have worked at this factory, and there are dozens of families like theirs. Brothers founded the company, Homer and Shakespeare Lachlan, presumably a literary family. They jumped on a new fashion for whiter, more refined dinnerware. Sarah Vaudry of the area's Ceramic Museum described their beginnings.
They were the young whippersnappers in the pottery world, and they were the ones who ended up successfully firing 4 kilns worth of whiteware before any of the other potteries could, and then they won a prize of $5,000. And that's what launched the Lachlan brothers into pottery production on a big scale.
Around the turn of the 20th century, the company changed hands. The new team built a new plant on the West Virginia side of the river, and those long, low factory buildings are still in use today. Then in the 30s, the company created Fiesta, cheap, colorful, cheerful dinnerware. It was a hit even in the Depression. In 1948, Homer Lachlan really stepped up the production of plates and bowls. They designed and built their own machine inside the factory. Dave Conley, a longtime employee and unofficial company historian, calls it the Big Flat Automatic.
This is the Flat Automatic Digger. You've got 3 machines here, and each one has 2 heads on it, so theoretically we could be making 6 different items at a time.
He said that's 3,000 dozen pieces every 8-hour shift. People who make dishes talk in dozens. You'll have to do the math. I'm giving you the history because it's all still happening. The buildings, the machines, the kills, Fiesta, and the owners are all still going. Of course, there have been improvements. Computers control the firing now. A 3D printer speeds the design process. Ceramic engineers found a way to make glaze shiny without using lead, all done in-house.
The people that owned our company have always put profits back into the plant to modernize. And we've always had state-of-the-art equipment. And I call that state-of-the-art even though it's as old as it is. It's almost 60 years old.
He's talking about the big flat automatic. It still works. By this time, we had walked the entire 37-acre factory floor and were standing on a loading dock. But inside the old buildings, on the chilly day we were there, with fog pouring off the Ohio River and drifting into the windows, we watched the ware come out of the fire, magically transformed. Creamy orange, intense red, vivid turquoise. Bright pottery stacked in bins and crates piled all over the place.
I remember the first time I actually went to the facility and looking around, and I'm thinking, boy, am I back in the 1940s or what? I mean, even the office, it isn't all spruced up. It's the old look, and they're focused on making product and not being flashy.
That's Bruce Smith, head of the union representing the pottery workers. He says while nothing about Homer Lachlan is flashy, the workers do make decent money.
You know, they are good jobs, and they're making a living, being able to buy a home and raise a family and retire with some dignity.
Both management and labor consider that an achievement.
I'm very proud to have kept this business here in the Ohio Valley. It's very important to us.
Elizabeth Wells McIlvaine is the first woman to lead Homer Lachlan and the fourth generation of her family to run the plant. Her immediate family now owns most of the business. She told us that Homer Lachlan China stopped producing Fiesta for a time in the 70s. Harvest Gold and Avocado Green didn't sell. But in 1986, Bloomingdale's department store came calling, looking for a retro China for their stores, and Homer Lachlan made a typical, practical decision. Restart an old line, revive Fiesta for retail sale, along with their existing hotel and restaurant business.
We have two sides of the business, and that's helped us tremendously because it seems when one side of the business, the retail side of the business, is flourishing, the hotel side is having problems, it's having difficulties, and vice versa.
It helps that Fiesta has a big fan base. Collectors stand in line for hours to get into the factory tent sales. Fans meet, they swap, they critique the company's color choices, and they wait for the new Fiesta color, which is unveiled each March.
Oh, they always have suggestions. The one year, they all wanted fuchsia, and they all arrived to Homer Lachlan to go on their tours dressed in whatever fuchsia they had. That was their silent but very loud statement.
The folks at the factory steered us away from fuchsia as next year's color, manufacturing problems, they said. But they offered no color clues, says Miss McIlvaine.
That's a very deep, dark secret. Not to be told.
I'm Linda Wertheimer for NPR News.
It was another stomach-churning day on Wall Street. At one point, the Dow Industrials were down 460 points, a huge drop that came on top of four consecutive days of stock market losses. The decline more than wiped out the year's gains, but then late in the trading day, stocks started to recover, and by the close, the Dow's loss was a little more than 1%. As NPR's Jim Zaroli reports, investors seem to be worried about a global economic slowdown, the Federal Reserve's next move, and even the Ebola virus.
October has sometimes been a catastrophic month for the stock market, and though this month isn't that bad yet, it sometimes felt today like disaster was lurking. Stock prices plunged sharply in the morning, came back a bit, and then fell again. At one point today, the Standard & Poor's 500 index was down nearly 3%, and that came after several days of steep losses, but it recovered some of its lost ground by the end of the day. Randy Frederick is Managing Director of Trading and Derivatives at Schwab.
Given that we've seen volatility spike up to levels that we haven't seen since the fall of 2011, I would consider that there's a bit of fear out there right now, and that's something we haven't seen for a very long time.
Frederick says investors are growing more and more worried about how much the economy has slowed in Asia and Europe. He says Germany, for instance, largely escaped the consequences of the last downturn in 2011.
But we've seen recent significant declines in German GDP. We've seen sharp drops in German business and investor confidence. And we see really the European Central Bank kind of in a position where they are talking of doing things, but they can't seem to come to a decision on exactly what they are going to do. And I think some people are beginning to question if they have any true ammunition left to combat this.
Compared to Europe, the U.S. economy continues to grow at a pretty good pace, but a string of bad economic data today left a lot of investors questioning how long it will keep doing so. Retail sales plunged more than expected in September. And then there's the Ebola virus. In addition to all the other bad things it would do, an outbreak of the disease in this country could wreak havoc on U.S. trade and investment. Doug Roberts is chief investment strategist at Channel Capital Research.
All these things are kind of hitting at one time, and people are now saying, you know, I want to reduce my risk exposure very, very quickly.
With all of these fears mounting, investors did what they have so often done. They pulled their money out of riskier investments and into the safety of U.S. Treasury bonds, and that drove interest rates down sharply. Jim Paulson, chief investment strategist at Wells Capital Management, believes investors may be overreacting.
The fact that the 10-year yields broke 2% again in a U.S. economy that arguably is in the best shape and fastest growing it's been in the entire recovery. I think that's a real disconnect.
But for now, investors seem to be swamped by fears. One other looming concern is where the Federal Reserve is likely to go in the months ahead. As the U.S. economy has improved, Fed officials have gradually made clear that an interest rate hike is somewhere on the horizon. That's not likely to happen anytime soon, but it's enough to add to the market's jitters at a time when there's already plenty of other things to worry about. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
The price of oil is plunging. Earlier this week, we told you it hit $89 a barrel.
Today, we can tell you it's down below 85, the lowest price in years, and down 25% in recent months.
As we'll hear this morning, there are many reasons, from the expanding supply of oil to the fact that oil is always priced in dollars. We begin with a country that traditionally has influenced the price of oil.
Future movements in the price of oil may depend on what the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia does. NPR's Jeff Brady reports.
We're at a service station in Glenside, Pennsylvania, just outside Philadelphia. The price here is $3.26 a gallon for regular. That's just a little higher than the national average of $3.18 a gallon. Martha Bernardino is filling up her car. Does it mean something to you if the price is 10 cents lower or 20 cents lower?
Yeah, sure it does. You get more gas, it's better for the economy. Sure.
Better for the economy, what do you mean?
Well, you have more money to spend in other places, don't you?
At the next pump over, David Best knows how he'll spend his gasoline savings.
I love reading, so I go to books or bills, paying bills.
All that money going into the economy and not gas tanks is like a free stimulus package for the U.S., according to economist Philip Verleger.
It's quite possible that Christmas shopping will be much better this year because consumers will be spending less for gasoline.
Verleger says a big reason prices are declining now is Saudi Arabia. The kingdom has 1/6 of the world's proven oil reserves, but that share is declining. Countries like the U.S. and Canada are producing more oil than anyone expected just a few years back. Today, Saudi Arabia is worried about competition.
They've decided to fight for their market share.
Verleger says the Saudis are refusing to cut production, allowing prices to plummet and hoping to make rivals cry uncle. He believes Canadian oil sands producers are a particular target. The Saudi Arabia embassy in Washington did not respond to NPR's request for an interview, but it's clear this move is controversial, both with less wealthy countries in OPEC and even within the kingdom. Here in the U.S., there are costs, too. What you save at the pump could cost someone else their job. Amy Myers Jaffe is Executive Director of Energy and Sustainability at the University of California, Davis. She says as prices decline, drillers will look for ways to protect profits by saving money.
What history has shown is that when oil prices come down, the costs of producing oil also come down through efficiencies that companies might get by, you know, doing the same project with fewer people or using better technology.
And Myers Jaffe says lower oil prices could upset global politics.
There are a lot of countries that are highly dependent on oil revenues. Russia, Venezuela, Iran, Nigeria, And those countries are going to become more unstable, as if we needed anything else to push some of these oil-producing countries into being more unstable.
Myers Jaffe says without this instability, she'd predict a long period of lower oil and gasoline prices. But geopolitics are just too messy right now to say that. Another factor is American driving habits. In the past, when gas prices went down, people drove more and bought bigger cars. But Myers Jaffe says that's changing. Millennials aren't buying cars and driving as much as their parents, and cars on the road today get much better gas mileage. All this means, when it comes to the oil market, the world is moving into unfamiliar territory. Jeff Brady, NPR News.